Seriously Potter listeners, this is Divya here to tell you about episode 18, which you will be listening to soon. Anyway, Elliot, Vanessa, and I sat down with Dino Carroll, a playwright, who recently wrote a parody of Harry Potter entitled Sally Cotter and the Censored Stone. It's a hilarious comedy, and you will learn all about it right now. Enjoy.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm happy to be here. It's very exciting.
Yeah.
It's good to have you all here.
But, and it's really funny.
Oh, good. I'm so glad you like
yeah.
it.
I was cracking up. I do theater at my school, and so...
You guys are, like, exactly my target audience.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
You know, folks your age who do theater really is like exactly what I'm aiming this for. Because I think it's the type of play that I would have wanted to do when I was that age. So
definitely. Well, so we have some questions prepared.
Great.
So, do you want to get started?
Yeah. Okay. So, first question: what inspired you to write a parody of Harry Potter?
Well, I've been a Harry Potter fan for a while now. The first time I encountered it, I mean, I think I had heard of it, but I was working on a play, a children's theater play, in the summer of 1999, and had the lead actors were all high school and college age, but we had some younger kids, about 10 or 11, doing sort of chorus roles. And every time we took a 15-minute break, they would run right back to their books, and they would just, you know, try to frantically get another chapter. And it was, I guess, it would have had to be Chamber of Secrets, because I don't think Azkaban was out yet in summer of '99 in the States. And so I could tell this was clearly a big deal. So I started reading it myself not long after, and loved them, of course, and immediately started to think, like, wow, could I put this on stage? And I did, actually, just on a whim. I wrote an adaptation of the first book. Knowing I could never actually get the rights to do a production of it, just for my own fun, I wrote it. And on a whim, I wrote to J.K. Rowling and to ask for stage rights, you know. And I actually got an email back from her people saying, well, you know, sorry, they're not available yet.
Yeah.
You know, which was nice. I mean, you know, I think the subtext was, and when they are available, you still won't be able to get them. But so then, you know, flash forward to the end of the series, because it's like fall 2007, and it occurs to me, hey, so I can't get the rights to really do it, but I could do a parody. I could do, you know, I could do a spoof. Those are totally protected under the First Amendment. So, yeah, so I wrote this, and it was just a total blast. It was so much fun. I love writing. It's what I do. But even on a project that you're excited about, so there are days when you just have to drag yourself to the keyboard and you're like, I have to get this done. I've got a deadline. But
yeah.
Sally Cotter, for whatever reason, I would just, you know, when I would get home from work, I would just dash to my keyboard. I'd be so excited to get to write a little more of this. It was so much fun to write. So then I had it sort of sitting around for a while, didn't know what to do with it. Sent it to some friends of mine who run theaters, and you know, they all liked it, but they were, you know, wasn't quite what they wanted to stage. And then I sent it off to, first of all, I got in touch with a friend of mine who's a lawyer, saying, hey, if I ever, you know, publish or produce this play, am I going to get sued? And he said, probably not, but he's just that I form my own LLC, and I have no idea what that really means. I mean, I've seen things that are LLCs, but I don't even know what it stands for. So I thought, hey, you know what, let's get this published. So I sent it off to Play Scripts, which is a company I've worked with before, and they do great work, and they published it, and actually it was just officially published last week, at the end of April. So I'm very excited
very cool.
to get this out there in the world.
Okay. Vanessa?
Okay, so what inspired you to come up with the censor character?
Okay, well, I was trying to remember that the other day. Like I said, it's actually been like a year and a half since I actually wrote this. I can't recall if I came up with the title first, you know, some play on Sorcerer's Stone, and then, you know, the word censor just came to mind or what. But, I mean, the basic premise is that, of course, you know, it's Philosopher's Stone in England, and then when they got it published in the States, they wanted to change the title. And I actually do think that was a good idea. I do think that they're right in thinking that kids, and they're particularly targeting young kids with the first book, wouldn't want to read a book with the word philosopher in the title. But some of the other changes that they made, like every time they changed sweets to candy, or in the first few books they didn't say Quidditch pit, they say Quidditch field. And I feel like, you know what, American kids aren't that dumb. So I thought, like, let's have a character, the real bad guy of the play. Let's have a character who's censoring this, who keeps trying to make the books sort of dumber, with based on the assumption that American kids are dumb. So I came up with this character, the censor, who keeps changing things to try to make the play more commercial. Even though it's all a dream. Exactly, it's sort of both a dream and a play at the same time. You really can't think too hard about this play.
So were you trying to base censor off of more what Scholastic had done in editing the books, or you had almost a New York Times reference in there when you talked about them creating their own kids' bestseller list? And...
Right. The censor is not a particularly a vicious attack on any one entity. I think Scholastic did a great job with the books. I think it was a little silly at the times to sort of segregate the bestseller list, but it's that sort of Nickelodeon philosophy of kids versus adult. So if I let's stack the deck and have the bad guys underestimate children so that when the kids win in the end, they're vindicated in more ways than one.
Yeah. Okay, Vivian?
All right. Okay, I have two words for you. Rybrand's accent.
Yes, Hagrid's accent. Well, it's so difficult to do a good Hagrid accent, you know? I mean, obviously, Robbie Coltrane did it so well, but he's actually from England. So I've done some reading of the book aloud, on road trips. I read aloud to my wife for a while. I was trying to record all of Half-Blood Prince so she could listen to it when she went jogging. And I was okay with doing most of the voices, and I had a pretty good voice for everybody, but Hagrid was just so hard to nail down. Sometimes you would do him and he would come out like, he would sound like Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins, and sometimes he would sound Scottish, and sometimes he'd sound Australian. And I guess it's a West Country accent, so it's sort of like Welsh or just, the western part of the UK. It was very difficult to nail down for me. So I made the running gag be that even that he's called Rybrand in my play. He's Ruby as Hagrid becomes Ruben on Rybrand in my play. But he's even he doesn't know where his accent comes from.
Yeah, but I just have to say that was one of my favorite parts about this.
I know. One of the best lines is definitely Australian with a speech impediment.
Yes, yeah. with chimney sweep with the so several people offer him valuable suggestions to what his accent might be.
Okay, Vanessa.
Where did you come up with the game of Quizzical-ish?
Well, I enjoy the Quidditch sequences in the book, but I've never really thought it made a whole lot of sense, the sport. I mean, it's fun and there's great drama in it. But I don't understand, why you got 150 points for the snitch. I know she explained it in the Quidditch of the Ages book, I don't understand why is it 10 points and 150 points? Why isn't it just 1 point and 15 points? It never made a whole lot of sense to me. So I thought, I have to have a Quidditch parody because that's one of the things that's so important in the first couple of books, and the play is a parody of really just the first two books. So I needed to have a version of it. I thought, let's just make it completely ridiculous. So in a generally very silly play, that is certainly the silliest part. Quizzical itch by the time they're eating sandwiches and throwing stuffed animals at each other and stuff.
Yeah.
I have so much fun saying quizzical itch. I just kept saying it over and over in study hall yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, making up the sort of the parody names of everything was kind of fun. That's one I like. I'm very proud of Albus Dumbledore becoming Albatross Underthrower, which is a name I came up with before his sexuality was revealed. So it's not like in any way like a dirty joke. It's just underwear is funny, and so there's an underwear joke. Quizzical itch was kind of fun, and I realized some things I changed just to be different, instead of saying wizard I say sorcerer, instead of a cloak it's a cape, It's, yeah, instead of an invisibility cloak, it's the invisibility, inaudibility, intangibility, unsmellability cloak. Yeah, you can't do anything. You could taste somebody who's wearing the cloak, but, you know,
taste, I love that. So, what was your favorite part of the play, either to write or just in general?
Let's see. I really like the censor's monologue towards the end when he or she, that's a character that can be played by a man or a woman, it's unspecified, reveals the evil plan all along. That was a lot of fun. Beyond that, I'm actually proud of the moment that it's not just silly. That, I didn't want to just do, you know, Mad Magazine or, like the scary movie, epic movie type approach to these things. Because I love the books, and I really think J.K. Rowling did such an incredible job in creating these and really, changed the world of literature and really, had a deep effect on a lot of children's lives. And so I want to, not just children, but, ages, 5 to 105. So I want to pay tribute to that. So I'm proud of the moments in the play where it's where it gets not exactly serious, but where it actually expresses my admiration for the original works and what they accomplished.
Yeah, where it makes a good statement.
Oh gosh, thanks.
Divya?
What are your hopes for this play?
I would like it to get, staged a lot by middle schools, high schools, even elementary schools, I think, could do it. Summer camps, children's theaters, anything. I think it's very adaptable. It's I think you could stage it for relatively inexpensively. There's not a lot of special effects required. But if you do have the budget to do special effects, to do lots of lighting and costumes, there's certainly opportunities for stuff like that. It's got a flexible cast because there's the main characters, and then there's a chorus of students who do a bunch of stuff, and that chorus could be, like 5 students or 50 students. I think it's adaptable, and I think it's something that that schools would want to do. So I really would like it just become a staple. That schools do. They do, Our Town, You Can't Take It With You, and Guys and Dolls, and Sally Potter and the Censored Stone. That would be my dream. If a Broadway producer called me up and said, hey, I want to, put this play on 42nd Street, I would probably not turn them down. But I don't think that's the future of this play. I think the future of this play is a chance for fans of the Potter books to get to sort of play characters who are almost the same as the original.
Vanessa and I were talking yesterday, and she said, can we use the script we got to perform it? And I said, we have to pay them to actually perform it. And
you
she
do.
Said,
yeah, I wish that I could. This is my job, and this is how I make a living. So
Vanessa
said, we need to buy this script so we can do it for.
You do.
You need to pay royalties to play scripts, but they're. They're pretty reasonable as these things go, and they're a good company too. They treat their writers well, and they promote their plays well, and they really sort of come at the process of publishing plays and getting plays staged from a creative point of view, not just from a corporate point of view. It was founded by two young guys. I think they were like right out of college when they started it, and they're playwrights themselves, and I think they've. I don't know how much money they make as the owners of the publishing company, but I think they make a fortune as actual playwrights because their own plays get done all the time by schools. I'm afraid that I cannot. This is not shareware. I cannot let this free into the world. But he stated for no money, but it's worth your money. It's worth the money you'd have to spend. Let's say that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we have a drama club in the middle school of our school, mm-hmm. and they could actually be really interested in this. The teacher that teaches it right now is retiring, so I don't know if it's going to continue. But
oh, do they have a replacement?
I think they're going to have one of the other teachers that's in the high school generally.
That's
well, actually,
good.
No, she's
yeah, well, just, yeah, when I was in junior high, I wasn't even in middle school, probably junior high. We didn't. It was sort of. I was unfortunate to catch a time when there wasn't an active drama club, and luckily we brought in my uncle, who's an actor. He directed a couple plays when I was in eighth grade. But yeah, it would have definitely been where I spent all my time if there had been one.
Uh-huh. Okay, Vanessa?
So Underdrawers hinted at a sequel. Are you planning on writing one based on the other books?
I would love to do a sequel. Yeah, because I mean, like I said, it's only based on the first two books. So there's so many characters who I would love to do a version. I'd love to do a version of Sirius and Lupin and you know, Wormtail and that whole gang. But so I'd love to do a sequel. Yeah, I sort of just see, you know, if this is successful. And I mean, of course, you know, it's a sequel to a play is kind of an odd thing. I mean, a sequel to a movie, you know, so you get back your old actors and all the people who saw the first movie come and see it. But let's say you guys did this at your middle school next year, and then I wrote a sequel and I released it, you know, the following year. But if you guys had, you know, played all the roles, then you'd be moved on to high school by then, and then so you'd have to get a new actress to play Sally and a new actor to play, you know, Rybrid and Harmonica and Dave and all the other characters. So it's not exactly the same thing as doing a movie sequel. And I want to do it. If PlayScript is interested in publishing it, that'd be great. I might just do it for kind of my own edification and just have it be my own. It would have to be a sequel where you don't need to have seen the first play to get it at all, you know? It has to be, you know, the same basic framing device of the real Sally falling asleep and it becoming a dream. That's the plot of the play, that she falls asleep while reading the Harry Potter books and then she dreams that she's in a parody version of the Potter world. Have to have the same, you know, basic premise. She falls asleep. Oh, well, here I am having another dream. Oh, hi, audience. I had a dream a little while ago that I was in, you know, in this world, and it looks like I'm having another one now, you know. Don't assume that people have seen or read the original.
Uh-huh. What would you say to people who think that the parody insults Harry Potter?
Oh, well, I mean, I know that some Potter fans are so protective of this type of thing. Actually, I think one of my first ever experiences with fandom was sort of like fall of 2000, I think, and I was on a website, and Dave Barry, the humor columnist, he was still doing his newspaper column back then, he had just done a column that was a Potter parody. He said, since J.K. Rowling's busy, I'll write her next book for her. It's called Harry Potter and the Enormous Royalty Check. And it was just a very sort of silly thing, and it was... it was a lot of fun, and I went on this Potter website, and some of the fans were just freaking out, and they were insulted by it, and they thought it was, you know, so awful that he would do this, and I thought, like, oh, don't you understand? Popular things get parody. That's what happened. You know, if there's something successful, there's going to be, you know, a parody version of it. And sometimes they are insulting, sometimes they are aggressive and mean, but this is not one of them. This is definitely the work of a fan. This is something that I wrote. I mean, part of me, I wrote this because I thought this was something that would be popular, that people would want to do. Part of me, you know, did it for the same reason I think people do Wizard Rock, that people do fan fiction, that people, you know, start websites or podcasts, is that, you know, this is something that's important to us, and we want to be a part of it, you know? We want to sort of have a piece of it that's ours. You know, it's this whole universe right now, and everybody wants to have one little corner.
I think that's so true, because I just felt so left out after the books ended. So that's probably the reason the podcast came to be.
Yeah, I think that would have to be the plot of the final play. I think that if I do sequels, it would probably just be a trilogy. Probably do two more plays, and the last one would definitely have to be Sally has the final book in the series before she falls asleep, and maybe she keeps trying to prevent the play from ending because she doesn't want the series to end.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Now we've turned this into a depressing interview.
I know.
Okay, so you mentioned at the very beginning that parodies are protected by the law. You also...
Yeah, actually put that into the play.
Yeah. So, have you heard of Steve Vanderark?
Oh, sure, yeah. The whole lexicon thing, yeah, and that was definitely on my mind when I contacted my friend the lawyer.
Yeah, so were you afraid of something like that happening?
It's only a little tiny bit afraid, because first of all, you know, parodies are generally protected. Secondly, as I understood it, the problem with what Mr. Vanderark was doing was that, at least the original version of the lexicon, and I guess he's working on an expanded version now, was sort of just sort of repeating and reiterating, you know, stuff that Rowling had said, just sort of describing things that she had created without adding any sort of commentary or, you know, research or criticism or anything like that. I think that you know, this play avoids that it does offer some, you know, some criticism, whether it's, you know, just a little light criticism like Quidditch is kind of silly, or whether it's and when I say criticism, I don't necessarily mean negative criticism. I mean, you know, any sort of commentary, whether it's, you know, like, you know, this book has changed the world, and so it's sort of analytical. I think satire and parody is by nature analytical, that, you know, it's sort of looking at the original, you know, and what it's attempting to do and what it succeeds in doing, what it fails in doing with any sort of a parody. So I think that by doing that, I am, you know, going that next step that the original version of the lexicon didn't do, by offering some analysis and some criticism in with the jokes about underwear and Canadian mouths.
So, Vanessa?
Going slightly off the subject of the play, when did you start reading the Harry Potter books?
Let's see. Like I said, I sort of encountered them in summer of 99. I think I didn't start really reading them until probably spring of 2000. And I just, you know, I devoured all of them. I think I hadn't quite yet finished Prisoner of Azkaban when Goblet of Fire came out that summer. But I was... So I think I got the book, you know, at midnight, and it was on my shelf, and I was, you know, zipping through Azkaban, which is probably still my favorite book, to get to this suddenly new massive tome that had just arrived for me. That whole summer was just about reading Harry Potter. Once I'd done the whatever else I was doing that summer, and it was a great summer. I've been to it since early 2000.
So, how deeply involved are you in the Harry Potter fandom? Are there any sites you check regularly? It's okay, you don't have to, like, say us.
I discovered you guys fairly recently, because I was, you know, searching around, you know, trying to find a podcast that I could try to get on to shamelessly promote myself. So, you guys are a fairly new discovery, I was definitely a regular listener to some of the somewhat more high profile podcasts. We didn't name any names. I am active on two of the Potter social networking sites, one of which is by those big podcast people. We, again, didn't name names, but if you're on that one, look for me. Just Dean O'Carroll. I didn't use any wacky name. Beyond that, let's see. I mean, I certainly do listen to some Wizard Rock, not a ton. I'm getting more into it. I've done some live shows, but I do occasionally feel very old when I investigate fandom. I'm all of 32, but when I realize that, you know, some of these people who are, you know, so into the fandom, you know, don't remember a time without Harry Potter. You know, it was they started reading Harry Potter as soon as they could read, and it was you guys must be roughly like that, right? You were
That's us. I think I read. I think my mother actually read the first Harry Potter book to me.
Same here.
When I was about, trying to think, six, probably.
Yeah, I must have been in first grade or something, and my mom would read me the Harry Potter books, because I just love to read, but that was a bit big for me, so.
Sure, yeah, that's six, definitely. It's a really interesting line that you draw, that, you know, what... You know, things that were sort of always there when you sort of became aware of them, and then things that were brand new to you as you're growing up. Like, I think Disney movies are like that. So, for me, any Disney movie that came out, you know, certainly after I was, you know, like 10 or so, and definitely anything, and maybe even stuff, you know, that came out after I was born, you know, feels like, oh, that's the new stuff. That's not sort of as authentically real Disney to me. So, like, I mean, I love Aladdin, I love Beauty and the Beast, but those came out when I was in high school. So they don't, you know, seem like, well, the real Disney stuff came out before I was born, you know, Cinderella and all that stuff. So, so I guess probably for you guys, Potter is like Star Wars would have been for me. You know, the first Star Wars movie came out the summer I turned one. So, so it was almost always there in my life.
Yeah.
I didn't really remember time pre-Star Wars. So even though there was new stuff coming out as I was growing up, it was, you know, it was always there for me. So, yeah.
Yeah, probably when we remember the 90s, I usually think of Power Rangers and stuff. Now, when they think of the 2000s, we're going to think Harry Potter.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely true. Boy, you know, I was chatting with somebody recently online who just did, she's a college student right now, and they did a stage play that was, they just transcribed old episodes of Nickelodeon shows and just performed them.
Oh, wow.
Which sounds really fun, but then she listed what shows they were. It's like, oh, those shows were after my time with Nickelodeon. For me, Nickelodeon was like, you can't do that on television, and Hey Dude, and Rated K, stuff you guys probably have no idea what I'm talking about. you know, and she was, you know, doing, I don't know, the Angry Beavers and SpongeBob and stuff that was a little after my time.
Uh-huh.
And we've wandered way off topic.
I know. Yeah. Divya?
So, when did you first start writing plays?
Oh, geez. Let's see. Well, I was a writer since, you know, since I could start writing. I would write stories and stuff, and I would try to write plays because theater was always a part of my life growing up. My father's an actor, my uncle's an actor, my brother is. So I would go see a lot of plays that, you know, that they were doing. Well, I mean, we didn't, you know, trek down to see Broadway shows and stuff. I mean, we could have. We didn't live too far away. But just mostly local theater, children's theater, things that they and people they knew were involved in. So it was always sort of a part of my life. And I would try to write plays, but I didn't really sort of buckle down and write a play until I was in high school, because my high school drama teacher did a weekend of student-written plays every year. So I wrote one, and it was just such a great experience. I mean, I loved acting, and I loved other aspects of theater, but you know, that experience you get, particularly when you're writing a comedy, and you get a big laugh off a line that you wrote, and just, you know, then it just fills up the whole theater. It was a rush unlike anything I'd ever done before. So I really, you know, stayed right with that. So I went to college and I wrote plays there. A children's theater that I've been working with as an actor for a while started asking me to do adaptations. So I did adaptations of, you know, Wizard of Oz and fairy tales and you know, classic books and stuff. And I've been working with that theater. It's gone through several iterations, but I've been working with that theater ever since my first play with them was 1996. So I was counting the other day. I'm up to like 23, 24 plays with them. So, and then I went to grad school and got a master's degree in writing plays. And now I live in Hollywood, so I'm trying to get work writing for television. But, you know, theater is always first in my heart.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm in a play right now at my school, and just the feeling, I didn't write it, but just the feeling when you get a laugh is really great.
It really is. What's the play?
Moon Over Buffalo.
Oh, well, that's a funny show.
That's a funny show.
It's a Wonderful Life. Oh, it certainly is. Which part are you?
Howard, I'm Howard, are you? But yeah, that's my part.
Gee, oh, is it the young guy whose mistake for Frank Capra?
Yeah, that's me.
I'll take it with you. Oh, sorry. Yes. Oh, yeah. That's a fun show. And Ken Lubin's other play, Lemmy Tanner, is mm-hmm. if anything, even better.
A very good play. What other plays have you written?
Let's see. Like I said, all my children's plays have been adaptations of a famous title. So, you know, like I said, fairy tales or children's books and stuff. Some of those are published and get done by children's theaters and schools around the country. And then I've written adult plays too. Which don't get done as much, because, you know, when because, you know, who am I? I'm not a famous name. I'm not a name that's been drawing anybody in. But, you know, like, Cinderella is a name that will draw people in. So, you know, if you've got a famous title, that'll bring an audience. So a bunch of plays for children, a bunch of plays for adults. And like I said, now that I'm in LA, I'm trying to write the, you know, screenplays and television plays and stuff too.
So you mentioned earlier you were pretty into Disney, and I checked out your vlog spot on Sally Cotter. It mentions that you go onto the podcast called Inside the Magic. You're a guest on
Yeah, Inside
that show.
The Magic. Yeah, it's a great Disney podcast. It's more about the theme parks than about the movies. But I went through a big Disney phase. Shortly after I moved to LA, my wife and I got annual passes to Disneyland, and we were going, you know, twice a month, and I just really got addicted to it. And I started listening to these podcasts about the Disney parks. And then I just started contributing little comedy pieces about the Disney parks, about the sort of observations I had, or just sort of, you know, silly stuff to this podcast. And when I first did it, I thought, like, you know what, you know, I think maybe I should just remain anonymous. I don't want to, you know, use an agent, you know, hey, you know, maybe I'll get hired by Disney to write for, you know, for the TV show or the movie or something. So I started off just asking to be anonymous, and then the name I wound up getting on the podcast was That Anonymous Guy. So there is That Anonymous Guy. It's the least clever pseudonym ever. So I'm sort of slowly in the process of outing myself as Dino Carroll and not as That Anonymous Guy now. But yeah, check that out. I haven't done anything for them in a few weeks, but go back, check the archives. I'm in there. If it says That Anonymous Guy brings us another hilarious something, then I'm on it.
That's you.
Yep.
Yeah, podcasts in general are just a great way to get involved with something you're interested in.
They are. Yeah, I didn't sort of fully get what they were before I actually got an iPod. I mean, I'd heard the term. I knew they were out there. I thought, like, well, who would listen to those? And then I realized, oh, yeah, I would listen to those. I love those. Because you know, they're so specific. They're so, you know, I mean, just among the Potter podcast, there's ones that are, you know, only about, you know, the movies, ones that are only about a certain movie, ones that are only about a certain character, only about Wizard Rock, only about Filk. Only about, you know, a literary analysis, only about, you know, sort of, a silly comic analysis. It's great, the variety that's out there. And I realized also that, you know, why I'm doing this, why I'm talking to you, why I'm trying to talk to other podcasts is PlayScripts is going to promote this play really well. They'll put it in the catalog, it's on the website, and they'll send it out to schools and theaters, and they'll do a great job. So what I can do to promote the play is talk to fans, you know, talk to the fandom, which is so huge, which is such a an impressive creation, and I think that, you know, that's my part of promoting this play is you know, doing the podcast and the websites and so on and getting it out there to, you know, for lack of a better term, the little people, you know. You guys might not actually, you know, run the drama club at your school or, you know, run your own theater, but you know the people who do, so you can say, hey, check this one out.
Yeah.
Well, we will, for sure. It's a very funny play. It was so creative that you just put right out there that it was a parody. Because a lot of parodies don't do that. They kind of make you do that, but it was such a creative way to do it, and I just thought it was very funny.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I the whole, you know, sort of framing device where it's a dream allows me to sort of have it both ways, to do it as just, you know, the parody, but also take it a little bit seriously. That, you know, early on, you know, Sally, the main character, and yes, you know, I changed a few characters to female because just remembering my own middle school, high school drama days, always there were more girls who wanted to be in the plays than guys, and so I wanted to try to create a gender balance in the for the cast. So Sally, you know, she's reading the books and she falls asleep and she, you know, has this dream. And she knows it's a dream and she knows that it's very silly, but she also knows how much she, you know, how important the books are to her. And so she realizes how important that, even though she knows it's a dream, even though she knows it's a very silly dream, she still manages to get caught up in it. And she and Underdrawers are the only people who seem to be aware that it's this is just a fairly ridiculous dream.
Yeah, I thought that the play was a great way to promote the series. Like, I can't see how people might be insulted, like, but it's a good way to show how great the books are.
I hope so. I mean, you know, I don't want to give away the ending, but the final battle against the villains, the actual use of the books, which are never named. I never actually name Harry Potter or J.K. Rowling by name, but I don't think I'm fooling anybody as to what the books are.
Yeah.
The actual book itself becomes very key in the final climactic scene.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any other questions, guys?
I'd like to know what your favorite character in the script was.
In the script, my favorite character in the original books is Dumbledore. I love Dumbledore, and when I reflect back on it, I feel like, I mean, geez, that's, you know, in a way that's one of the least inventive characters. I mean, there's so many great characters, like, you know, like Hagrid. I can't think of any other characters quite like Hagrid out there. But, you know, every fantasy book has, you know, the old bearded wizard, you know, the wise old wizard with the white beard and the flowing robes. But yet, there's something about Dumbledore that's more than that, you know, that's more than just that stereotype. I mean, you know, you just love that he says, I want to say a few words, nitwit, blubber, oddment, tweak, you know, that he says that he always really wants to get socks. People always give him books, but he wants socks for Christmas. You know, I just love that stuff. Anyway, but in the play, I love Underdrawers. I love Rye Bread. I might say that the Censor was my favorite character, because maybe because I could be totally mean to the Censor. You know, that all the other characters are based on this character that I love, and maybe I would have held back a little bit. But since I created the Censor myself, I could just be totally totally cruel to him or her, and have bad things happen, and have that character just be totally objectionable and awful.
Uh-huh. Well, he was almost like, all I could think of was Umbridge when I read him. He was rather,
I suppose, yeah. Umbridge does sort of take that type of role in book five. I don't know if I do the sequels, I don't know if I'll be able to find room for an Umbridge character, because that's a great character. That's probably my favorite villain in the series. Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, the sequels are a ways down the line.
So, any questions that you have?
Any questions? We're all out of our written down questions.
Okay. You have to say where people can find out information about the play?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the little sort of quickie website that I set up is sallycotter.blogspot.com. That's, and Cotter is spelled with a C, so it's sallycotter.blogspot.com. And you can also go to the publisher's website, and they are playscripts.com, playscripts.com. And it's one of their new releases right now, or otherwise just do a search for Sally Cotter. And that should answer any further questions that you might have.
We just like to give you a high five because we're fellow blog spotters. So.
Oh, great, great. Yes, I wish that I had the computer acumen to really create a real sort of whiz bang website. But I really just need a place to put in like an FAQ, and eventually I'll put like updates when they start getting to be productions. I'll say, oh, there's going to be a production in, you know, Midland, Minnesota. If I hope people send me photos they can put up, and, you know, just a sort of a general place to locate it all. And
yeah.
Blogspot's just great for that.
Blogspot is great. See, I'm looking through the script right now. You sent us very nice copies for all of you at home who are listening. We felt very special when we got them.
All right.
Yeah.
I wish I could keep sending out free copies. I can't now that it's officially been published. I'm not allowed to send any more free copies. But you can read almost all of it online for free. The PlayScript website offers very long sample plays. Really, all but the last couple of pages.
Wait, the surprise ending.
Yes, they. I think it was. I think actually, they actually go past the surprise ending.
Oh, really?
just like the sort of the final wrapping up that's not included. So.
Oh yeah, I love the reference to how after every single book, Dumbledore has to explain everything that has happened up until that point.
Yes, yeah. Early on, Underdora said, like, well, I gotta go now, but I'll see you for some end of the story exposition. And then shows up in the end. Yes, yeah, the first few books definitely have that that format. Like, okay, here's what just happened to you. Let me explain.
And then even finally in book 7, when you think it's not going to happen, Dumbledore still shows up and gives them an
exposition. Well, yes, even beyond the grave, Dumbledore still shows up. Yeah.
Oh. Well, I think we are all finished, unless there's anybody else has any other questions. We didn't quite have time to put out an announcement and get any questions from anybody else, but...
Well, hey, if you ever want me to come back on, I'll do it.
Oh, yeah. That'd be great.
That would be fun.
Yep.
And we successfully did our first Skype podcast. Another good achievement.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Well, all right. Goodbye from Seriously Potter. I'm Elliot.
I'm Divya.
I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Dean.
We'll see you next time.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
So we hope you enjoyed that little interview with Dean O'Carroll. Hopefully we will have him on sometime again. He was really cool and fun to talk to. Email us, guys, because you know you want to. Here's the contact info. You can email our main email about the site and other stuff at seriously.potter.awesomeness, AWESOMNESS, @gmail.com. You can email us podcasters at seriouslypodcasters@gmail.com. Visit our website at seriously-potter.com. Please remember, seriously is spelled SIRIUSLY. You know you want to email us. You know we want to read your emails. So do it already. Come on, guys. Oh, and if you want to see us on Twitter, check us out. Twitter.com/seriouslypotter. Go there. And be awesome, because you know you're going to have lots of fun. And this is Divya, hoping you liked our episode, which I know you did. See ya. Oh, and please enjoy this music by The Hush Sound, which is way better than We the Kings, and you just need to email Vanessa and tell her that. The Hush Sound is way cooler. So please enjoy this song entitled A Dark Congregation by The Hush Sound.